Now, you've written an article called The Financial Coup d'Etat, and you've talked at length now about a lot of elements of that. Where would you date that back to?
I would date the financial coup d'etat back to the planning, I think, was 1991. And then it really got going with the passage of the World Trade Organization. But if you look, they planned out the Uruguay round of GATT and implemented it. So, you know, that went into effect, I think it was the beginning of 95 or 96, and then it was off to the races. But if you look at the planning and engineering, the GATT was happening as a global treaty. If you look at the engineering that was going on in the domestic economy, that was paralleling. So the design of the housing bubble was the same period that they were pushing the Uruguay round, and it really clicked in. Because what we came up with, and this is what I describe in the Dylan Reed story, we made a decision to literally take the war on drugs to a whole new level, create private prison companies, and we basically started dropping, and this was 95, it started at the end of Iran-Contra, 89, 90, but it really got going, I think, what I saw with the private prison companies. We dropped SWAT teams into neighborhoods where we would just round up innocent kids, stuff them into prison. You know, we pulled the money on the public defender's offices, so they all had to cop a plea. They couldn't really get serious defense. And so we're rounding up innocent kids, putting them into private prisons that are making money on the stocks. And then the private prisons enter into contracts through Unicor with the Department of Defense. So you have them working for the military, and there's no difference. If you look at the engineering of it, it's exactly what Hitler did. He rounded up populations, put them in slave labor camps, and then they made uniforms for the military. It's no different. And it was scary to me, Bonnie. I'll never forget in the 90s trying to explain to people this is what was happening. There was one month when the Wall Street Journal, they were trying to make this socially acceptable. The Wall Street Journal had an article about Park Avenue co-ops using prison cabinets and prison materials in the kitchens and bathrooms and how this was the new style. And GQ did a layout of men in fancy business suits in prisons, you know, in front of the cells. And this is the power position. You're the guy who puts them in prison, not... No, it was unbelievable, and it was frightening because there was nothing we were doing that the Nazis didn't do, because these were innocent kids. Or if they weren't innocent, they'd simply been entrapped to deal drugs to the people who were arranging to throw them in prison, you know, by 1 or 2 degrees of separation. And it was as though the whole society pretended that this wasn't happening.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. I saw a lot of that on the ground. I used to live in Venice, California, and we had a community paper that we used to paste up and work on in it's a tiny little ghetto there. But the SWAT teams would go house to house. A little kid going by on his bicycle would be attacked, just swept up. And one of my good friends at that time had worked in the public defender's office, and he had to go out on it was either disability or something like that. He couldn't handle the caseload. It was just too much.
Right.
He had so much work to do. I mean, the guy practically had a nervous breakdown.
Right.
I remember all of this.
Right.
And, of course, it continues today.
Right.
In the Sonoma Valley, where I live, which is rural and beautiful. I mean, just the other day, I saw a tank driving through the Sonoma Valley, and on the side of it, in huge yellow letters, it said SWAT. And there was a guy dressed in military uniform driving this thing.
You're kidding.
No, I mean, I never saw that before. So this continues. It's very scary.
This is why it's good I'm an optimist. I wanted to just show you a graph. You know, I love this framework. I have these little graphs that help me, the rule of thumb. And this one is a two columns and two rows, so it's four quadrants. And the two columns are who and what, and then the two rows are global and local. And what are, you know, non-living things? So what things are the banking system or currencies or technology, or it's what stuff, you know? And who are people and other living things, okay? And my view of the world is everything, you know, when I pick up an annual report when I'm looking at a company as an investment advisor, the first thing I look at is who owns it, who runs it, who's on the board, who manages it. And one of the things I've been trained to believe and has absolutely proven to be true is where you have excellent leadership, things work. And where you have terrible leadership, things don't work. And there's a theory that's grown up in the American economy that government should protect us from bad leadership. I have news for you. There's no government in the world that has enough money to protect you against bad leadership. You know, and that's why I keep telling people it matters where you bank. You know, who runs the bank where you bank? Who runs the store where you shop? It matters that you have people who are excellent, who care about you. You know, and if you do business with criminals, you're going to lose your money. We've lost our ability to discern between people who are excellent and people who don't have our best intention at heart. So the first thing I always look at is who. And when you talk to many people these days about solutions, it's like who is not allowed to be discussed. You know, we want to talk about whether community currencies are a solution, or banks, community banks are a solution, or kill the Federal Reserve is a solution. Well, when you talk about these things on a place and people blind basis, terrible things can happen. Because what I want to know about any solution is, who does it empower? Now, you can implement a solution that's a great solution or is a terrible solution. And whether or not it works depends on who you put in charge of it. So the notion that we can have any solutions without talking about who is nuts. Now, one of the things that happens when I go over and try to talk about who on a global or local basis, you know the first thing that happens?
What's that?
The first thing that happens is I run into divide and conquer politics. Because what you'll notice is the first thing that Mr. Global does in any phase of the financial coup d'etat is he's got a divide and conquer thing going. So you're turning men against women. You're turning Muslims against Christians. You're turning the young people against the old people. And you've got massive divide and conquer to make sure that this side of this column can't start building alignments and getting something done, okay? You want to keep them powerless. And powerlessness comes from being divided. The minute we start to align interests with each other and see each other as allies and find a way to gather power and build wealth on a decentralizing basis, you know, that has power. Now, if you keep us from talking about who or thinking about who or building alignments, if you keep us divided and conquered, but then channel all our desire to be part of a productive solution into what stuff, then you can game us all day long. Okay, so let me give you an example. The county bank idea. So the other day I was at another financial salon, it was in Santa Cruz, and we had a woman there who's writing a book about how wonderful county banks were. And she described the idea of you create a governmental county bank. And in fact, because now that you have a governmental county bank, you don't need any of the community banks. Okay, so now we're going to wipe out all the family wealth, and we're going to wipe out all the enterprises of the small banks that have kept small business alive.
And you're talking about privately run small banks.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're going to take all the community banks. So assume in a community we have 5 community banks and 5 credit unions. Okay, so now we're going to wipe out all the community banks, and we may wipe out the credit unions as well, because we're going to have a county bank that has a governmental cost of capital. And now we're dependent on one bank. We don't know who's going to control this bank. We do know that they're on digital systems that ultimately, and clearance systems that are going to be controlled by the Federal Reserve. So now instead of having a variety of different banks locally, and banks that create, you know, family wealth locally, we're going to have a governmental bank that's going to be controlled centrally. And this is supposed to be a solution. It was really funny because I really wanted to communicate to her that she had a problem. And I said, you know, what you're proposing is fascism. Because if you come into any county, the thing that's keeping us alive, you know, in most counties, we're down to, you know, in a small county, you know, 20 to 50 families who have either small businesses, small banks, or small farms. And if you look at what's been happening in the economy for the last 20 years, the people centralizing the economy have done everything they can to shut down those small businesses, shut down those small farms, and shut down those small banks. And what you're proposing to do is to do something that will be a death blow to the small banks who are financing and keeping those small businesses and small farms alive.
And you're saying that the county bank, the county public bank, would be a competitor with the
private bank.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming. Now, you know, the North Dakota model is you have a state bank that really helps the community banks be healthier. So I think a state bank that supports and builds up the community banks could be a great idea. But again, it comes down to how these things are done. Because think of anything in the financial world or the technology world as a tool. And I can use a hammer to hit you over the head and kill you, or I can use a tool to help you build a house. And so the tool's not bad or good. It's, okay, how are we going to apply this? And I think the key thing for any of the financial solutions that might be useful, we have to get back to this question of, okay, who's running things? So let me jump to a county. The most important thing when we talk about real solutions is ourselves. Okay, let's look at my time. Let's look at my money. Let's look at my actions. And let's look at whether my mind, my body, or my money and my resources. Number one, am I using my time and my resources in a way that I'm not permitting the tapeworm to harvest me? Okay, so have I figured out how to get the tapeworm out of my mind, out of my body, and out of my pocketbook? And what I will tell you with most Americans is the answer is no. First of all, they don't control their mind. They're digesting enormous amounts of popular media that's full of entrainment technology. It's full of the most sophisticated subliminal programming and brainwashing. I mean, we are the targets of massive amounts of engineered mind control. Okay? So that's number one. So number one, you know, because if I had to tell you, if you want to save the planet, turn off your TV. You know, just your time is precious. There's not enough time in the world, you know, to incorporate that amount of, you know, sort of mental junk. So number one, are they out of our minds? Number two, are they out of our bodies? So I'm always trying to get you to watch Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. I
yes.
want everybody in America to watch Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. If you look at Phil Staples go from being 420 or 430 pounds and literally nearly dead to shimmering with health and vitality in life. I mean, it's a incredible transformation in the movie. If you look at pictures of him since then, because he's just kept on juicing, you know, what you realize is we don't need national health care. We need to stop eating poison. Okay. And if you just look at one guy who looks completely hopeless and you look at the extent to which he becomes healthy again, what you realize is, okay. So number one, you know, get the poison out of your mind. Number two, get the poison out of your body. Number three, get it out of your pocketbook. If you look at all the things everybody says they hate, they're financing it. You know, so if you're banking at Chase Manhattan Bank, you're financing it. You know, don't complain. The problem is not them, it's you. Well, I have a long article we're going to publish in a book in a month or two called Coming Clean.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we need to do each ourselves is to come clean. Because by coming clean, I prevent the system from harvesting me. And by preventing the system from harvesting me, not only do I make myself stronger and more powerful, but I deny them access to that amount of resources. So you're just withdrawing. Now, part of this, you know, part of all of this is getting the dirty players, you know, out of your mind, out of your body, and out of your pocketbook. One of the most powerful books I've ever read that inform real solutions is Robert Axelrod's Evolution of Cooperation. You and I have talked about it. And Axelrod sat down, he's an economist, and he sat down, this is about 30 years ago, and he said, how do we build an economy where peace makes more money than war? How do we build an economy that is cooperative, not destructive? And he did lots of computer simulations. And what he discovered is, in a world where there's transparency, the clean players are more productive and succeed and beat the dirty players. But where there's no transparency, the dirty players beat the clean players. So having a world where enforcement can happen requires that we see who's the clean and who's the dirty player. Now, in my experience in America, America admires the dirty players. I would expect, we're in Berkeley, I would expect if you took me into an audience of activists and I was free to just for an hour ask them questions in front of you, I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they admire the dirty players, not the clean players.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
You mean the people like admiring power, for instance?
Mm-hmm. They admire power and they respect force.
Yes.
And
yes, I've seen that too.
Right. Yeah. And the message to the clean player within business, within government in this country is we have no respect for you. You're a loser.
Right.
And the dirty player gets the respect. And that's a negative feedback loop that has nothing to do with the top guys being corrupt. That has to do with the rest of us being corrupt. And the corruption in the general population in that way is absolutely phenomenal. Now, you've heard my story about being at the Christian revival. It's a perfect example.
No, I don't know.
I had a wonderful minister who I took a spiritual warfare class that was outstanding. And she had worked at the DEA. And there's nothing about drug dealing by the Bush family or allegations about the Bush family and the Clinton family drug dealing. She didn't know. And we were at Women Thou Art Loosed, which is a conference by T.D. Jakes, who's a fantastic preacher from Dallas. And T.D. Jakes had brought George W. Bush in by monitor in 2000 during the election. And 100,000 Christian women jumped up cheering for him. And they're all African-American, okay? And this minister jumped up cheering. And afterwards, I said to her, you know, Minister Pat, you jumped up cheering for George W. Bush. And there's nothing about Bush family narcotics trafficking or allegations thereof that you don't know. And her son had just been shot at in a drive-by shooting the week before. And I said, and you just jumped up and cheered for him. You've never jumped up and cheered for me. And I just lost, you know, a fortune, and I almost lost my life trying to stop this stuff. And she said, well, he's going to be the winner. And I said, so he's a winner and I'm a loser. And she said, yeah, that's right.
Isn't that terrible?
No, it's not terrible in the sense that, you know, I look back on the last 20 years and there's a whole series of honest people whose honest expression of the truth really helped me understand what was happening. So, and she was just being honest. And that was a very powerful insight for me, because what I realized was I have to be able to operate for decades with one being hated and no admiration. Because in our society, you know, the people who win and get all the money are the ones who are admired, not the people who do it the ethical way.
Right. Why not go with a winner, is the saying. Yeah.
Right. And so if I'm not going to go with a winner, then I have to know that, you know, okay, I'm going to take my own route and I need to be prepared to go it alone.
That's right.
Right. And so, you know, you need to make that decision, but that is the way it is. And we are in a society that respects the winner. You know, and the winner is a dirty player. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. You've got to play with Mr. Global. You've got to play with the tapeworm, with some very rare exceptions. You know, and I can take you into any group of activists and I can prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt. I just had a rip-roaring discussion with a group of activists because a lot of the issues that hit solution come down to technology and privacy. So, you know, my read of a lot of the social media and a lot of the digital platforms is they were created to make it easy for the intelligence agencies to track and understand. You know, everybody's creating their own personnel file and dossier for the intelligence agencies and then teaching people how they connect. And so these systems are designed to manage and monitor and manipulate people and to get people, you know, if I walk around with my quote-unquote smartphone, Catherine Albrecht is now deemed it a cellmate. If I walk around with my cellmate and constantly feed into these systems, then I'm very easy to manage and monitor. And the digital systems can give people control. So, for example, when you talk about a county bank, depending on how you set the digital systems up, to me it's just something that's very centrally controlled, especially if you combine it with digital currencies. So we really have to look at those kinds of issues. But we have a population that is not looking at that in a very savvy way. And it's part of the confusion you get into when you start looking at solutions, because something can sound wonderful until you realize there's complete digital control from the central headquarters.
Now, with regard to transparency and people's worshiping power, do you believe that it all gets back to transparency, that if there were, in fact, transparency to who was who and who was doing what, do you still think that there would be such an abject worship of power?
I think that the transparency could help enormously. Even with complete transparency, we still have a general population that tends to respect force. And so if you have one group that have the ability to kill with impunity, they're going to tend to side with them. The ability to act above the law with impunity consistently over long periods of time is the ultimate power. You know, so if I can act above other things, it means I don't have to pay taxes. So I have an enormous financial advantage, among other things. And so the population will constantly tend to side with the people who have that power just because they view that as a way to remain safe.
Right.
And so the enforcement question gets back to, okay, you know, how do we deal with that? If this group is above the law, do we have a system where they're free to break the law whenever they want and we have to obey the law and we're just going to adapt a feudal, that's basically feudalism. Or are we going to do something about it? Are we going to make it difficult for them to do that? And that, of course, gets back to the question of who are they and why are they behaving the way they're behaving?
And what are we going to do to change things?
Right. It's very interesting. I had a relative once who's an attorney say to me, it was during the 2000 election, and there was a group who were trying to get me to run for president in the New Hampshire primary, not in a serious way, but to illuminate the issues and get a fuller discussion. And I wrote an article saying why I declined to run for president of the United States. And so this relative called me up and said, okay, I want to know, what would it take? Just give me a list, and if you got this list, you would agree to run for president of the United States. And I said, okay, the first thing I want is I want a license to kill 250 people without question. So I want a legal right to be able to order the assassination of 250 people without question. And he just went wild. He said, that is the most lawless, outrageous. How could you do that? You know, he's deeply, deeply offended. And I said, you cannot possibly clean up this situation without the ability to enforce. And I can't enforce against people who can kill with impunity unless I'm free to kill them, you know, because I need the general population to respect me. Unless I have the power to kill and kill broadly, they won't respect me, you know, and that's the world we, you know, I felt like the Godfather. This is the world we have chosen.
Very, very Machiavellian. Yes.
Well, I mean, yes. It's just, we're talking nuts and bolts.
Right.
You know, how am I going to get anything done? You know, this is a terrible thing to say about him, but given who I am and given my background, that doesn't offend me. I mean, if I was going to govern the situation and get something done, I would need that power. So when I look at the president under the NDAA saying he wants the ability to kill people, well, you know, and my concern is that would be terribly misused, so I don't want them to have it. But in the meantime, you know, I wouldn't do that job without that.
Well, yeah, but also the people that he would pick to kill wouldn't be the people I would pick to kill.
We have an expression in Tennessee, he needed killing. I was raised a Quaker, but I didn't, you know, I never quite resonated with the philosophy